Thank you very much. My name's Nathan Weeb. Today I'll be presenting work that is very much analogous to some of the stuff that was presented yesterday. We'll be talking about quantum simulations, or not yesterday, on Monday, quantum simulations, time-dependent Hamiltonians. And this is, again, analogous to the work that Andrew White and Chris Monroe presented. But we're approaching it from the exact opposite extreme. We're assuming that we have a fully error-corrected quantum computer. Then given this powerful resource, the question is, what classes of Hamiltonians can we simulate given this assumption? And this is collaborative work that is done with Dominic Barry at Waterloo and Peter Hoyer and Barry Sanders at University of Calgary. So the outline of the talk is I'm going to discuss, well, what I mean by a quantum simulation, because this is important. I'm going to introduce the computational assumptions we have for the Hamiltonian and our model, and present really what we believe to be the state-of-the-art in general-purpose quantum simulation schemes for quantum computers. So when you think about a classical computer simulation, what you're really usually thinking about is solving the Schrodinger equation. So you have a very large matrix that you may wish to, you know, diagonalize to find eigenvalues or eigenvectors, or you may wish to find the known state. The problem is, as I'm sure you're all well aware, this is a very computationally expensive problem. The best known approach to get information out of the Schrodinger equation is solvable in p-space, which means that you can find information using a polynomial amount of storage, but unfortunately an exponential amount of time. So there's no real efficient way known on a classical computer to be able to get this kind of information out. And as was alluded to previously, perhaps we can do better on a quantum computer. The idea for how these quantum computer simulations work is as follows. We essentially use the quantum computer to emulate a particular quantum system that we have a description for. So the idea is we begin with an initial state represented in this Hilbert space for the quantum system we wish to study. The quantum system may or may not be physical. It just has to have a concise description. So we start with a quantum state, and then we devise some sort of an encoding to encode that quantum state as a state in the quantum computer's memory. So we encode that in here, and then what we do is we perform a series of fundamental operations on the quantum computer to map the initial state to a final state. Then if we've done this simulation well, that final state will decode back within some promised distance epsilon to the final state that you would expect in the simulated system. Now this is an important point. It promised to be within distance epsilon. There isn't a very good known way to perform quantum simulations and test the error as you're going about, because obviously, if you measure the system, you're going to destroy your data. So this is a difficult thing. We have to have promises in order to guarantee that this unknown state that we end up outputting from our quantum simulation is close to what we would normally see in the system. And this is one of the difficulties behind rigorously doing the simulation. Now, the limitations behind what I'm calling quantum simulation here is that we can, of course, only extract information from this output state by measurement. And another problem is that, of course, we can't measure the state efficiently. We'd have to do quantum state tomography on this, and that isn't an efficient procedure. And finally, in order to do this efficiently, we do have to start with some information about the Hamiltonian. We can't just generically throw in any Hamiltonian. We have to promise bounds on its norm and various other properties like this in order to guarantee we're within distance epsilon. However, if these assumptions are met and we are guaranteed that we're looking at properties of the output vector that can be efficiently measured in the state, then this actually can be done in polynomial time and give a huge advantage over the best-known classical algorithms. So the simulation problem we look at is the most general one considered so far. We do not assume that the Hamiltonian has a tensor product structure. In fact, we don't even necessarily assume the Hamiltonian is sparse. We assume that the Hamiltonian is time-dependent and the sum of a set of other time-dependent Hamiltonians, each of which is d-sparse, which means there are most d non-zero matrix elements in each row and column. And each of these is d-sparse in a particular known basis. Okay. The other thing that we have to assume is that the Hamiltonian is differentiable p times for some promised value of p. And we have to have an efficient algorithm for calculating upper bounds on this. Finally, we, of course, need to have efficient quantum circuits. We're doing the basis transformation to go to these bases in which each of these H alphas are sparse. So that's the assumptions that we bring into for this particular model. We also postulate the existence of oracles that end up giving us information about our Hamiltonian. The first one over here, called BB, basically what it does is you give it a row, give it a column, and it will give you an encoding of a matrix element of a particular H alpha at a at a given time, okay? And the second one essentially allows you to identify the locations of the non-zero matrix elements in a given row. All right, so this one over here gives you the values of matrix elements. This one tells you where all the non-trivial matrix elements are. All right, and we use these two resources in order to be able to do our calculations. So what's the idea for our simulation? Well, basically what we do is we break this up into two steps. We want to use some sort of a primitive Hamiltonian that's easy to simulate. If we can break up our Hamiltonian into a sum of these simple Hamiltonians, we can use something like the Trotter formula to be able to approximate the time evolution operator. So, first step is exactly that. We break up H into a sum of one sparse Hamiltonians. Then, we use something analogous to a Trotter formula to approximate the time-ordered operator exponential that describes our evolution operator. And then, once we've broken this up into a sequence of one sparse operator exponentials, we use the fact that these have been proven to be efficiently simulatable on a quantum computer to say that we can if n is polynomial, then we can simulate this sequence over here efficiently on a quantum computer one slice at a time. All right, so it's very similar to what Andrew White was talking about with slicing up the time steps in order to do his simulations. You might be wondering, why the heck are one sparse operator exponentials efficiently simulatable? And the answer is that it comes from a very nice structure of the spaces. So this is a particular one sparse Hamiltonian. You notice that there's these blocks over here that we get in these two locations. If we exponentiate it, we have the exact same structure. We've got these irreducible one and two dimensional subspaces. If we multiply this by the vector on the right, we notice that this beige block up here will mix vectors, the vector components A1 and A2 together, but it won't affect anything else in the Hilbert space. So the idea for simulation is simple. If you write a quantum circuit that can evolve an arbitrary irreducible subspace of this, then by applying that circuit on all of the subspaces, we can evolve each one simultaneously using quantum parallelism. And that's really how quantum simulation ends up getting its advantage here. So, how the heck do we break it up into a set of one sparse Hamiltonians? The idea actually is borrowed from graph coloring, but I won't bore you guys with the details of that. Essentially, what we want to do is, if we have a matrix of functions like this, which is, in this case, two sparse, we want to break it up into a sum of different operators that are one sparse. And to do this, we applied graph coloring technology. And it's interesting because the best known result says that a d-sparse Hamiltonian can be broken up into d plus 1 colors. This is known as Vising's theorem. But the problem is the graph coloring requires you to go through the entire graph, and that's an inefficient algorithm. So the best known quantum algorithm for determining whether or not a particular matrix element is in a given one-sparse Hamiltonian will require 6d squared different labels in order to be able to do it. And an example of this algorithm being applied is over here. So as you can see, it uses three colors in order to be able to do this task. But really, we could have done this actually with only two using Vising's theorem. But it's not efficient. The next part of the simulation algorithm is, how the heck do we actually do this trotterization process? In order to get an advantage over the best known quantum simulation schemes that have existed before ours, we needed to apply this higher order Trotter formulas than currently are used in most time-dependent simulations. And the best known scheme is the Lee-Trotter-Suzuki formula. The problem is, it's wrong. But this is how the idea works. The idea is, you start with a symmetrized version of the Trotter formula, known as the Lee-Trotter formula. This thing has an error, which is order delta t cubed. Then, you use this recursive formula proved by Suzuki. You plug in your approximation into the recursive formula, and out comes a fifth-order formula from your third-order formula. You don't have to stop there. You can continue outputting getting the output of this formula and plugging it back in, turn a fifth order formula into a seventh order, then a ninth order, then an 11th order, and as high as you need. Okay? And this helps you get very good temporal scaling out of this. The problem is it's wrong. His theory worked fantastically for time-independent systems, but for time-dependent systems, it turns out his derivation was only valid if H is analytic. And this is an example of the error that's noticed for a particular non-analytic Hamiltonian and an analytic Hamiltonian divided by the error scaling that you expect. So for the analytic Hamiltonian, you see that the Lee-Trotter-Suzuki formula is behaving approximately constantly when you divide by the error scaling that you expect. Over here, it's increasing linearly. So rather than the delta t to the fifth scaling that you expect from his formula, you're actually only getting to the fourth because of the fact that HA is non-analytic. And by analytic, I mean it doesn't have a convergent Taylor series. So we had to go and fix his derivation and go through and take into account what happens when you don't actually have an analytic Hamiltonian, because analytic is far too restricted of a class for us. And we found, I won't bore you with the derivations, it's a 20-page proof on the archive right now, essentially you can slice up using these Lee-Trotter-Suzuki formulas to an appropriate order. You can do it to kth order if the Hamiltonian is differentiable 2k times, and you can guarantee that the error in your decomposition is less than epsilon using a number of slices that's greater than this. Okay? So this is the main step in simulation. We've got a promised bound on the number of time steps, essentially, that we need in order to guarantee that the error is less than epsilon if we've done everything right. Okay? And this is really where our cost estimate is going to come from for the simulation. So the number of oracle calls that we have is real simple. It's that value of R, it's the number of time steps, times the calls per time step. And the number of qubits will be the number of qubits needed to store the matrix element, plus the number of qubits needed to identify an invariant subspace of a one-sparse Hamiltonian. So this is the cost that we end up getting once we do this. And one of the key points is this scaling that we see over here is, again, within a constant multiple of the best known result proven for time-independent Hamiltonians if H is analytic. If it is not analytic, then we can't end up increasing the order of our decomposition as high as we want because of this analytic problem that I mentioned for the Lee-Trotter-Suzuki formula. So we're stuck. And then in that case, we do not get as good scaling as the best known results for time-independent Hamiltonians. But we still get quite good scaling. The next thing that I'd like to mention is that if we take a look at this function over here, if we assume that H is analytic, then it can be shown using a value of k-naught that I had in on the top over there that this portion is subpolynomial in delta t. It's been proven that linear scaling of the number of calls to the oracles is the best you can ever do without violating quantum lower bounds on parity searches or parity checks. And so what this means is that we're within a polynomial factor, or a subpolynomial factor of the best possible results for analytic Hamiltonians, which is actually kind of an amazing result, I think. So to conclude, this method handles the broadest class of Hamiltonians that are considered so far. We permit Hamiltonians which are non-sparse and time-dependent, which is a major advantage over the rest of overall previous simulation methods. However, the performance depends on the number of promises you're given. If you are not given promises about the bounds of the derivatives of the norm of the Hamiltonian, then you can't apply our Lee-Trotter-Suzuki formula to as many times as you like, and you won't get optimal scaling. The performance will eventually cut off. And as I said before, we have nearly optimal scaling for the analytic case, which is a remarkable result. So thank you very much.